Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network, sponsored by TBILaw.com.
For automatic reminders about this radio show and other great survivor events,
sign up now for TBISN.org.
When Attorney Gordon Johnson speaks about recovery, he isn't talking about the amount of money a survivor gets from a lawsuit or settlement. He is talking about getting better from the brain injury. Find him on the web at TBILaw.com or call 800-992-9447.
And now, it is time for another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Hi, everybody. So glad you're all here tonight. We'll take care of a little housekeeping up front. The East Coast is getting blitzed by a snowstorm. Our guest actually lost her power and is probably up to her kneecaps by now in snow, but her power's come back on, I hope. And we'll be having Rosemary join us shortly. Again, we want to thank one of our sponsors, Gordon Johnson. If you have any litigation surrounding your TBI, check out his website at tbilaw.com. We're also very excited. Not only have we expanded Brain Injury Radio to 7 nights a week, 7 different hosts, 7 different perspectives, same time, same place, same number, but we're about to launch on March 20th. I believe, a peer support line. And that's going to be a 1-800 number where people can call in survivors and or caregivers and talk to another survivor, thus peer-to-peer support 24/7. We are looking for some volunteers, and what you would be signing up for is 4 hours a month. So if you have 4 hours a month, I have to tell you from my own experience of being a host on Brain Injury Radio that it's really added to my sense of purpose, and you have to give it away to keep it. So it's just been a really cool experience to get help and be helped by other survivors and to to get to talk to the caregivers and other interested parties. So if you are interested in volunteering 4 hours a month, please get a hold of any of us hosts. You can go to braininjuryradio.com, leave us a note there. We have a Facebook page, Brain Injury Radio. You can reach me through my inaflash.org site. There's a tab up top, Contact the Author. That will send me an email directly. And it's easy to get a hold of us. We're all over the place, but we would love to have more volunteers, and we're really looking forward to kicking off the peer group support line. Also want to remind you that all of these live broadcasts are archived pretty immediately after the show ends and available for on-demand listening. So they're archived and you can listen to the program at your leisure. So if you miss part of a program or you just want some of that support before that 24-hour hotline comes up, please go to the on-demand section of Brain Injury Radio, scan through. You'll see all the different topics and different hosts. Listen to a few programs, and you'll find a lot of comfort there. I think, part of what I've been doing on the program, I've either introduced a recovery since the show is recovery now, I've spoken about tools that have to do with recovery. We've talked about a lot of different tools. Self-hypnosis. One of our hosts, Keith Anthony, is on about every other Saturday. I'll have him come on and tell us exactly which Saturdays those are. But he is a master of self-hypnosis, visualization techniques. We've talked about those on this show, MDR, DBT, 12-step programs, body work, energy therapy, all kinds of tools. And sometimes I'll introduce a topic and we'll talk about the topic and have our callers call in and give us information. Other times I've interviewed survivors, both of TBIs directly and acquired brain injuries, as DJ, one of our other hosts, taught me, like mine, a ruptured brain aneurysm. But so far, I haven't had the opportunity to interview someone from the other side of the fence, from the caregiver side of the fence. And when I wrote my book, I was writing my story, what happened to me as a survivor. And you know, I made mention of my parents, who are the ones most directly involved at that time, and the person who was to become my fiancé and husband for a short time. But I never really got a feel for what they were going through, because as a survivor, you know, you've got your end of it. The caregivers, you certainly empathize and sympathize with what they have to go through, but we can't walk in each other's shoes because that's just not our story. And so when Tracy, one of our regulars here on Brain Injury Radio, talked to me about Rosemary, and I got her book, I've got to admit I'm not finished with it, but I'm halfway through it. I was really wanting to have her be my first caregiver, the person with the other perspective on my show, and I feel so fortunate tonight that she was willing to come on the show and share with us. My guest tonight is Rosemary Rollins. She's the author of a book called Learning by Accident. It's a memoir that follows the intense two-year period following her husband's severe traumatic brain injury in 2002. Rosemary's gone on to be a speaker and a caregiver blogger on brainline.org. I'm going to bring her on in just a moment, and when we start talking, I will see if any of you guys want to type in these websites for me, or I'll type them in once we get going. But you can visit Rosemary's website directly, and that'll tell you where all you can get the book, Amazon and the usual haunts, but it's RosemaryRollins.com. For those of you in the listening audience, RosemaryRawlins.com. And brainline.org, all one word, BrainLine, is a fascinating website where she's recently become a caregiver blogger. That website has lots of cool information on it, and I've used it before. Thank you, DJ, so much for showing up and taking care of that for me. Without further ado, I'm going to bring on Rosemary. Are you with us? Did you get your power back?
Yes, I did. Can you hear me okay?
I can. You sound great for a lady in the middle of a blizzard.
Well, the snow has pretty much ended, and it's turning to a really messy, slushy, you know, probably something that will freeze overnight.
Ooh.
But it was a fun day. I like a snow day.
Yes, yeah. If you stay home, it's a...
It was. My poor husband had to go to work, but I was writing all day in my, you know, yoga pants. It's a nice kind of day to do that.
Super nice day for that. Well, Rosemary, thank you so much for coming on and being willing to share your story with us tonight. We've got lots of guests in the chat room, lots of people listening, and I think a lot of us share the sentiment that I talked about earlier, and that's that we hear a lot of survivors talk, and we don't often get the opportunity to talk to somebody who's been on the other side, you know, somebody with us through the ordeal and what your feelings are like and what you have to go through. And so I'm really happy that you're here. So this started for you in 2002. Why don't we just start from the beginning? Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Sure. Well, my husband and I, we had been married 24 years in 2002. We
wow.
had two twin daughters, and Anna and Mary. And then, and Hugh was a very, very athletic man. He had been doing sports all of his life, just about every kind of sport. He was an ocean lifeguard growing up. He raced bicycles, and he was a sailboat racer, and just an all-around athlete. And we were living here in Richmond, and it was April 13th, 2002. He was just going out for a regular bike ride. Literally, he rode had ridden his bike almost daily for 20 years, and he was struck by a car directly from behind at about 50 miles an hour.
Mm.
And, he went through the windshield, over the roof, and hit the pavement. And it was in an area where there were other cars, which was lucky because immediately they called the rescue squad. And I've read your book, Kim, and it's a lot like you. All the angels fell into place. The paramedic that came happened to be very well versed in brain injury, so he rushed my husband to, you know, the trauma hospital rather than go to just any hospital, which makes a big difference.
Yeah, I want to stop you right there for just one second. That's one thing we've talked about a lot. One of our guests recently introduced a protocol because you're one of the first I have ever heard, and I'm sure a lot of us, you know, the people listening have heard, that have actually recognized what was going on in the first responders and knowing to take them to a level one trauma center. So you're right, that is a miracle in and of itself, it seems, these days.
It really was. And I mean, there were so many of them, which I can get into as we go along. Just, you know, I think, sadly, a lot of what happens, I mean, it just is a matter of the timing and how things fall into place. And but I was at home. I had just dropped our twin girls off at a skating rink, and I was bringing groceries in the house, and I got a phone call, and someone on the other end of the phone just said to me, "Do you know a cyclist?" And the voice, you know that kind of tense voice you hear, that
yeah.
There's been an emergency. Immediately I thought, oh, my gosh, what's happened? And they said, rush to MCV Hospital. Well, at that point, you know, we hadn't gone to a lot of hospitals around here. And I really didn't even know that it was the trauma hospital. I hadn't been to MCV. I had been to closer hospitals. So I rushed. I had to get the address and get direction. It was just terrible. And I made it down there before they even brought him up to surgery. And I did, you know, talk to him. The chaplain told me I might want to say goodbye to him.
Hmm.
And I completely refused to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was, it's just such a shocking feeling. You know, one moment your whole life is just going along, as you well know, and the very next it's just, you know, you're in a completely different orbit, you know, a completely different galaxy, just terrible. So, but Dr. John Ward, who is happens to be an extremely talented surgeon, he's a protege of Dr. Harold Young, who the whole neurosurgical department is named after at VCU, he was the doctor in charge. So that was another thing that just fell into place, another really positive thing for my husband, and he operated on him right away. And you know, he was very honest with me. He said there were three scenarios that he might wake up and make progress and recover, or he might have some ups and downs and then recover, or he could die. So it really was very touch and go. And he had two brain surgeries in 3 days. The second one, they removed a portion of his skull, which I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of, to relieve brain swelling.
Right, right.
And because Hugh had developed a large blood clot in his right temporal lobe on the right side of his brain, and they had to cut that out and relieve the swelling. So, and then they put him in a coma. And all of this, on the caregiving side, you know, when you have two kids, they were just turned 14, Anna and Mary. And so they were middle schoolers, and, you know, it was terrifying for them.
Oh, and I'm sure for all of you.
Right. And as a parent, you know, you always want to protect your children. So you're trying to be strong. But this is probably the worst thing I'd ever gone through in my life is, you know, seeing my soulmate, my husband, my partner like that, in that kind of shape. So how do you stay, how do you put on any kind of a mask for your kids? You can't even do it.
Right.
And it's just a rough situation. So I think the stress, the book, Learning by Accident, is really sort of an inspiring book about, you know, both my husband's journey and my journey through his whole experience of brain injury. But there were so many things I learned from him, things that I picked up from our past relationship that helped me out, because I constantly thought about what would he do, you know, what would he want me to do, because he was so incapacitated, I couldn't talk to him. And it's very interesting how the relationship, I think, it goes on, even while the person's in a coma and everything. You're having these discussions with your partner, even though that they're not even, you know,
conscious,
awake.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So from a caregiving point of view, it is, you know, and I would say that I wasn't even caregiving at that point. I was more in shock. I think the nurses and the doctors are caregiving, and the family is standing by.
Right.
And the caregiving comes a little bit later, but. So that's really
surgeries,
how it all started.
Okay. So he had the surgery right away when he got to the hospital, and then the second surgery was when?
Just 2 days later.
2 days later.
He started to wake up the next day.
That's what I was wondering, if you got a chance to talk.
Well, no, he couldn't talk or anything. He was just squeezing our hand. And showing that he was maybe, you know, in there, that kind of thing. Like,
right.
But, you know, the nurses and doctors would do these neuro checks where they would sort of try to get him to wake up. They would pull on his eyelids to wake him up. And it seemed very violent to me, like, you know, pound on his chest, "You wake up, you know, show us that you're awake," that kind of thing. And, they said that when the family spoke to him, he might respond. And so Anna was the first one to do that, our daughter Anna. And she, you know, said, "Daddy, I'm here." And she grabbed his hand, and he squeezed her hand, and she almost jumped through the roof.
Oh.
And, you know, we were so excited. And, you know, we're all laughing, crying, and very excited, and spent the whole day at the hospital with him and part of the night, and then went home thinking, you know, in our minds, okay, he's going to get better from here on out. He's, you know what I mean? That kind of like relief.
Yes.
And the next morning, early in the morning, of course, I had a lot of trouble sleeping. I came downstairs and saw the phone flashing. I had put our phones on the chargers, and we had missed a phone call from a resident that he was having emergency surgery again. And that's when he had the second surgery, because I guess he had developed that blood clot. And that's when they took his bone out and did the craniectomy.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. And when I was reading about the squeezing of the hand, I thought, what a hopeful gesture under the circumstances, that was reason to give hope. It must have been terrifying to, once, the first time, you know, and then the second time, to even be able to fathom, well, a couple different things. You know, the brain surgery, for one, you know, that's no minor thing. And to have to then, what you must have all felt like with that second surgery.
Right.
And just, you know, the thing that you said, and obviously I could relate when I was reading that part of your book, was just, and all of us here that I'm seeing in the chat room have experienced it before, and you're just going along in your life the way you do every day, the way that a lot of people take for granted, and your world changes totally in a flash, you know,
right.
That fast, and it's just incredible. And I think you're right. There's a lot of shock. I know my family said they were in shock, not quite able to fathom all of that. It's a lot to process when it's so sudden and so severe.
Right, and I think TBI in particular is, I didn't even know what it was. This was 11 years ago now, going on 11 years, and, you know, it wasn't in the news the way it is now. It's actually so much more in the news, and even now I still think many people in the public don't have any idea what it really entails. But
oh, you're right.
Yeah, it is a repeated shock. It's the kind of thing, you know, the family keeps on getting more and more surprises because the doctors can't really tell you anything. There are so many unanswered questions in the beginning of this whole journey. When a person is in a coma, the doctors can't really say when they wake up, you know, what they'll be like or what kind of, you know, how extensive any damage might be or how difficult, you know, the journey might be, because every single person is so different. And it's just, it's unpredictable. And so I think, you know, as you go along, there are so many ups and downs and shock after shock after shock that it's different in that respect. It really isn't like a broken bone or a disease that you can fix with one kind of medicine.
Right. You don't really have any idea. And a lot of us here were told, our families were told, there was a better chance we would die than not. And, you know, you don't know what to expect as far as damage control. You know, when or if the person wakes up, didn't know how long. In my case, you know, I would be in a coma, story after story after story. You know, my story was the only one I knew for 17 years, and now in the last 4 months or however long we've been on 7 nights a week and I've been a host, I have heard so many stories, yes, we're the same thing. You know, we've been told the same, our people have been told the same thing, and it must just be a horrible sense of powerlessness.
Right.
Not having any idea, and there's not a thing you can do about it but hang in there and try to cope. How did you...
Right.
Well, let's go on for a moment, and then we'll go back to that. But so he's had his second surgery. They've put him in a coma. And how long was he out?
He was in a medically induced coma. So they were able to wake him up when they wanted to. They kept him in a coma for 7 days, and then they slowly pulled back medicine. And they did it intentionally because he was, you know, so severely injured, and he had had those two major operations. They felt like if his body were resting, they had an ice blanket on him, that if his body had to work at nothing else but healing at the brain, you know, they didn't even want him thinking, you know, any kind of activity. So they did that for the 7 days, and then he started to pull out of it. And you know, I expected him to sort of wake up like you see people in a soap opera and sort of sit up in the bed and go, "Hey, honey, how are you? What happened?" You know, that kind of thing. kind of had this fantasy in my mind, which is what I was bringing up earlier, how you feel as though it's shock after shock because, you know, you do have your misconceptions, and I had no idea really what to expect. And so when he did wake up, it was just very slow and gradual. He looked really frightening to me. His eyes were glazed over. He didn't look like anything. He was registering anything, mm-hmm. Almost like he was soulless. And it was frightening beyond belief. He was, you know, not making sense. Of course, it was hard to understand his voice. He had a breathing tube. He had a feeding tube. He had, you know, all of that. And so his voice was very raspy. And so that was, you know, the next shock. And then very slowly, he actually became more physical. He was much more cognitively injured than physically, I would say. Mm-hmm. Because as horrible as that crash was, my husband is known for having super dense bones. In fact, we had given him the nickname Huperman. His name is Hugh.
Yes.
He has really hard bones, and that was proven in this accident because he didn't break any bones. You know, he fractured his skull.
I was wondering about that as bad as that accident was, I thought about that too when I was reading. I thought, geez, I'm surprised he didn't have, you know, broken legs,
right.
Arms, ribs,
right.
Something.
Everyone says that, and I was shocked by it. I mean, he was scraped up. And he had a lot of road rash, you know, from skidding on the pavement. But he didn't break. One arm looked like it might have been broken, but it turned out it wasn't. And, yeah, so he was extremely fortunate in that respect. But the scary thing was he was moving around a lot. He started to get up, and he could walk. He lost a lot of the use of his left side. His left side was very weak, but that didn't stop him from getting up and falling down kind of thing.
Right.
And so he was kind of dangerous
because
right. He was very, very unaware and, you know, not cognizant at all.
Right.
And he was pulling all of his tubes out, you know, he would pull his feeding tube out 3 and 4 times a day and things like that. So it was, you know, difficult and stressful, really stressful for all of us to see him like this and not understand, is this going to get better? What's happening? That kind of thing.
This must have been really hard on the girls were so young when they saw their dad after surgery.
Yeah, and I think 14 is a very fragile age, too. It's,
yes.
It's kind of an age where, you know, he was a very protective, sort of, you know, powerful kind of father figure. And I think up until that point, you know, you have your... You think you see your parents as somewhat indestructible.
Exactly.
And I think that was very frightening to them to see that this, you know, this could happen. And then it's, you know, it's hard because they're automatically thrown into a situation where I feel like they lost both their parents because I was entirely focused on him.
Sure.
And, you know, prior to that, they were the center of our universe. So... Here they go from being, you know, completely cared for and the center of everything to almost having to hold me up.
Right. Good thing there were twins, huh?
Honestly, you know, I am very happy that they had each other. And I think it bonded them very closely.
I thought about that, too. And what a scary thing. They're just a couple years off from driving. I mean... All the changes you're talking about, that just the fragility of the age, like you were saying, and the shock of seeing that happen and the switch in the roles from being the center of the universe to seeing all this reality, you know, nobody
right.
should have to be seeing that kind of reality at such a young age. Very tough.
Yeah, it was tough for them. But, you know, we did have a really good foundation, I think, we're all very close. We have a large extended family. Not that they live close by. Nobody really did. But we have a lot of friends that felt like family. And so they had many surrogate mothers and fathers that helped them along the way, and I think that made a big difference for them.
Yes. Yes, that does make a big difference. I know it did. I know it did even in our case. I had a lot of people that were there that were of comfort to my family in the waiting room, and I know that that had to be huge because there was just the three of us, you know, as an only child, and I had been the center of my parents' universe, and at 35 was about taken away from them. So I don't know, you know, if they wouldn't have had those people with them in the waiting room and for those first few weeks, you know, how they would have gotten through. Again, you know, luckily they did have each other, but like you say, you can imagine much better than I how that must have been for them at that time.
Yeah.
And how valuable to have comfort people around.
Right. They had all of their grandparents around in the first several weeks. And we had, you know, a really close friend of mine from Vermont came. My sister, Mary, came. And her name is Kate in the book. The only name I changed in the book is my sister Mary's name. I changed to Kate because I talk about her so often, and I didn't want to say my sister Mary, my daughter Mary, my sister Mary, my daughter Mary.
I changed. The only name I changed was of my first husband, and it, I won't. And the one and that company I was talking about at the beginning, I didn't give the name of the client or the husband. Everybody else was the same. But yeah, I know what you mean, because I did have to do that later too, because on that chapter, Bob and Tom, the guy that I met at Boys Town, his name happened to be Tom, and I had to change that. So that's
right.
One of the things, there's a lot of people in the audience who have expressed desire to write a book, and those are some funny things that come up when you're trying to write one, you know. All of a sudden, everybody, you've got three Marys or Joes or whatever, and you know, changing the names so you can keep everybody straight, you know, in the dialogue.
Right. And it's pretty funny because they're both named Mary Catherine, so, and we always called my sister Mary Kate growing up anyway, so... It worked out fine calling her Kate, because she used to be called Mary Kate. And but yeah, so from, you know, I think the difference, and it's funny, I'm going to be giving a talk at the TBI conference in Williamsburg in May, and I'm talking with Dr. Kelly Gary, who also had a brain injury, and she's a wonderful lady, and we're going to be doing the two perspectives of a survivor and a caregiver. And I think, you know, it's such a different perspective in the beginning, because like my husband, he was unconscious and he doesn't really remember any of his time in the hospital.
Right.
He was in the hospital 33 days. And that's mm-hmm. probably was the most traumatic time for the rest of the family. You know, it's just such a traumatic time to see that and witness that and be sort of on that, in that holding pattern of, are you going to live or die, or how are you going to wake up, or what will the extent of the injury be? And all of that worry that goes into those first several weeks is such a difference. So, you know, he doesn't have any memory of it, and he has no real fear. And we're all a tiny bit neurotic.
Yeah, I was going to say. So, now, see, Yeah, there's a lot I don't remember, but I know I remember enough to be scared, so he's lucky. He's real lucky that way.
See,
okay,
he really didn't even have any memory of being in the hospital.
Really?
Oh, yeah. When he came home from the hospital, he had a lot of amnesia. When he came home, and, you know, in the book it talks about there's a scene on his last day in the hospital where a young resident comes in with a clipboard to give him a quick survey, and she says, you know, Mr. Rollins, do you remember anything about the accident? And he says, no. Do you remember anything before the accident? No. Do you know where you are now? And he looks around the room, and he has an IV in his hand, and it says medical waste on the garbage can. And she's in a white coat, and he says, in a government building?
Oh.
So, yeah, he was just clueless, and It was, and that's, you know, part of what the things that just sort of reveal themselves that way. Like, we had no idea that he didn't know.
Right.
You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Until
yeah.
that comes out. So it's just so surprising all along the way. And, you know,
how long was he in the hospital?
33 days. Not very long.
Well, yeah, it's just a month. How did you, it changes your home life around the hospital.
I'm sorry, I lost you for a second. It changes what?
Your home life. You're
oh,
away
yeah.
for a month
mm-hmm.
going back and forth.
Yeah. The kids stayed out of school for probably a week and a half or 2 weeks. And came every day and night. And then, you know, we were told it's going to be a very long haul. And so they started to go back to school with, you know, a cross between bus rides and rides from friends and me occasionally. And then I would spend most of my time at the hospital. But it is disruptive. But then having him home was difficult, too. We had to hire a night nurse because he was able – he was sleeping – on and off all day and all night. So it was like, you know, 2 hours of sleep, then being awake. And his sleep patterns were all messed up. And he had to wear a gait belt and a helmet because he had that, you know, the piece of his skull out. And so every time he stood up, someone, you know, me, I had to put the belt on him and help him walk and have his helmet on his head and everything. So it was like, you know, being chaperoning someone 24/7 for 3 months.
Oh, geez. And
yeah.
Well, and your strength, I mean, that must have been hard on your back and legs and trying to support someone's making sure they don't fall.
Yeah. He in the beginning, it was harder. He got strong pretty quickly. But it was more a matter of being vigilant because of that left side where he was a little off balance.
Right.
But as he got closer to having the accident, you know, he was in rehab, and they were working on his walking and everything and his strength, his muscle strength. It's amazing to me how much muscle you lose in the hospital.
Oh, I know. I know. I thought about that with him because he was in such good shape. You know, I think that had to have helped save his life, you know, the kind of shape he was in. And the same with me at that particular time. I was in the best shape of my life, and that had to have really helped. But the weight loss, the muscle tone,
yeah.
Of course, you know, when you're out for a month, you don't really realize, but you wake up and you're different, you know, not only mentally, but physically different. So it's a
right.
it's a shock all the way around.
Yeah.
All the way around. So in this month in the hospital, I just want to get a better feel for that before we bring him home. So he wakes up and he's got his physical strength, and that was causing some problems because he wasn't really aware of what he was doing with his physical strength. That was a difficult time. Did they started cognitive therapies and so forth when he was in the hospital?
Oh, yes. He had he was in the acute brain rehab at MCV for 2 weeks before he came home. And then he immediately, the day after he came home, he started at HealthSouth. And he had every therapy there is, you know, occupational, speech, cognitive, recreational, physical therapy. And, yeah, he had wonderful speech therapists. We were extremely happy with HealthSouth. And just really, really good people that were helping him. And then when he had, after 3 months, when they put his bone back in, he literally, within a week or two, got his left side almost all the way back, like miraculously.
Wow.
And that was interesting because he had been so weak at that point that he couldn't eat with his left hand. He couldn't pick up a cup or a pen, or he couldn't tie his shoes because he couldn't grasp a shoelace or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a week or two after the surgery, after they put that piece of his cranium back in, He just leaned over and tied his sneakers one day.
Oh, my goodness.
I almost keeled over. And he says, what's the matter? And I said, didn't you know you couldn't do that? And he says, no, you're embarrassing me. I'm just tying my shoes.
Wow, so his consciousness did come back. That was very aware.
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
I mean, a very aware thing of him to say. That
right.
You were making him feel embarrassed about that. Wow.
Well, it's funny, but because I don't think he realized that he couldn't do that.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
And it's just interesting to me. The whole way the brain works is fascinating, I think.
Yeah, me too. Okay, well, keep going. That's interesting. So he didn't really have to, he didn't have to stay. He stayed in the hospital long enough that he didn't have to go to a care facility in between like some of these folks. I too came home, and I know it had to have been very tough on my family, but you know, at that point, I wish this was so now, but I wouldn't trade the brain injury for it. I probably weighed less than 100 pounds by the time I got home from the hospital, so I was probably a little easier to carry around the house while I was learning,
right.
You know, to walk and think again than the time you had with your husband, I'm sure. So you had the night nurse come to give you a chance to get some sleep?
Yes, I would. I was taking Ambien at night. I was just a nervous wreck. And I couldn't sleep. I would, you know how you lie down to sleep and a million things go through your head.
Yeah.
So, and during the day, I just stayed so busy and active that, you know, I was hyper. But the minute I laid down, it was just this world of worry on my head, you know, from everything from his, you know, is he going to be all right, to finances, to how the kids are doing, to, you know, I just felt sick myself.
Right.
And so I took Ambien at night, and that was wonderful for me.
Put you right out. You didn't get up and eat the refrigerator or anything like some of those
side
effects?
No, I didn't do that. No, luckily.
Yeah.
But, and we had a wonderful night nurse. She would come right at 10 and leave at 6. And so I'd get her settled in, and the kids would say goodnight, and then I'd say, okay, I'm out of commission now.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of trust there because I was knocking myself out.
Well, you really
had
to. I mean, with all of the trauma from your end of things, you know, for over a month, and then having him come home, you know, I kind of wondered, I guess I'll ask my parents sometime, but what was, I suppose, equally scary for different reasons, but, you know, on one hand, you're scared when a person's in the hospital, but you've got, you know, all the professionals and the help readily available. And then
right.
You go home and nobody knows what to expect, and those professionals aren't right there. And I imagine that's, you know, while there's the relief you're not living at the hospital anymore and you get to come home, it's kind of like a now what? Because home isn't what home was the month before.
Right. And you know, the doctors had told us to keep the house very quiet and not, you know, keep it on the more on the darker side, not bright lights and all kinds of different things for agitation and all that. And, you know, we had two teenagers that took dance class and used to tap dance on the kitchen floor.
Oh, God, that so was agitating with a new brain injury.
I'll say. So, you know, it was a big lifestyle change. I mean, it was tough on the girls. There were no more sleepovers, none of that, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're at that age where they're very social.
Sure.
So, but, you know, I mean, you have good and bad days. We were certainly celebrating every move forward, and, you know, we were thankful that he had all his physical prowess. You know, we were just trying to get him more cognitively aware and everything, and that was getting much better as the days went on. And once he had that, like I said, the 3 months out when he had his bone put back in, that's when he really started to make good progress in every way. And, you know, a lot of doctors give you timelines, and we had different doctors tell us different things. One of them would say, you know, after 3 months I should have seen a whole lot of progress, but I don't think he's going to go much further than this. And that was such a mistake. I mean, that was totally wrong. Dr. Ward was, you know, my hero, and he always would say, you know, Rosemary, don't listen to any of those timelines. He said, I honestly think the brain heals continually throughout life. If you live a healthy lifestyle, that your brain can continually develop and you know, get better and better. And so I constantly just chose to listen to him.
Yes. Yes. And so how long was the recovery at home until, I guess, just tell us a little bit about, he spent how long going to the rehab center daily?
He went to rehab for over a year. It was at least, and he didn't do everything. The first rehab he was done with was physical therapy. And then after 5 months, he was in pretty good shape, but he still had cognitive deficits. Mm-hmm. And he had been an assistant accounting director, an assistant controller for a Fortune 500 company, really big executive job. And they wanted him to come back after 5 months.
Mm.
And we went through a whole lot of stuff, which is all detailed in the book.
Right.
The doctors didn't recommend it. They thought he needed more time to heal, but he desperately wanted to try it. And so he did. He tried it, and it didn't go well, and it felt like a huge failure. It was really devastating for him. And then he had a neuropsychological evaluation and found out that, you know, he had more healing to do. He had definitely had some deficits he had to work on, and that was really tough. And that was when Dr. Kreutzer basically said to us, you know, take some time to grieve for your old life and start a new one.
Exactly.
And
now, how had the job been? Don't lose that point. You might know that we survivors have memory problems, but how had the job been up to this point? Because obviously he was plucked out of his job without warning in the hospital for a month. Were they supportive?
They were wonderful. They were very good to us. They put him on disability insurance. He was on short-term disability, and then he was switched to long-term disability.
Mm-hmm.
We went on Social Security disability too. We had like mishmash of everything. Like you have to use all pieces
right.
of bits of everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a paperwork nightmare.
I know.
Yeah, and figuring out what all the benefits are. But we were fortunate because we wound up with 60% of his salary. And, you know, that's a good amount. And
sure.
It's not, you know, it's so much better than nothing.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. And I know
a lot
of
that disability insurance isn't taxed. So, you know, in
right.
reality, you're not out. I mean, you kind of trade it off. You don't have those social expenses that you had before. You probably weren't out shopping a lot, going to movies, out to dinner, but then you've got the medical incidentals. So, you know, it's,
right.
it's still certainly costing a lot of money. But, yeah, you were very, very fortunate that he had a good job with good benefits and that they didn't
right.
give you any grief and that he was so physically fit and got the physical part back. So I understand.
Right.
He must have been extremely frustrated. A lot of us talk about when you get to the point where you look normal and you're ready to get back to normal. And in those
right.
beginning times, when you're first finding out that that isn't going to happen, it is very hard. I read that, so I can say this. I'm not speaking for him, but, you know, a sense of failure and confusion and loss and that was a very wise person that talked to you about grief. I wish someone would have talked to me about that, and I could have started doing it a lot sooner, but I was enabled to stay in denial for a long time and continue getting those disappointments and
right.
not given the opportunity to accept, you know, mm-hmm. for a very long time. So that was a real blessing that person, even though I know how hard and disappointing that must have been for Hugh, that you know, that they put that idea of the grief in there, and you know, that it's not when one door closes, another opens. You know, a lot
right,
of times
right.
when we think it's the end, because it's the end of quote unquote life as we knew it, sometimes we feel like in the beginning, like there's a period there, but there's not. A new sentence starts. It's just
exactly
that tweener time where it's so hard because you know you can't go back, but you don't know what forward looks like yet. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I suppose for the whole family, while you're standing on that period in between sentences, it's a very scary, unclear time because change is upon you, but you don't know what that entails exactly yet.
Right. And he, you know, he did. I mean, we both crawled under the covers for a while and, you know, we were a little freaked out by it. But honestly, I think the main thing that pulled us out of it, one thing I always felt as a caregiver was if Hugh got very depressed, he would stop completely making progress. And
mm-hmm.
if I got depressed, he would be depressed. So I was very, very cognizant of any signs of depression and you know, determined to manage that as best I could and keep us moving forward. That was probably my main concern. And my big driver for that was Mary and Anna because, you know, we couldn't just sit there and mope around with two teenagers running through the front door with their backpacks every afternoon, you know, hey, Mom and Dad, you
right.
just, you have to be parents, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they were just a wonderful motivation for us to continue forward. And, you know, they were unbelievably wonderful to Hugh, and they were, you know, a huge factor in his recovery because, you know, there's nothing that's going to make someone want to do something like the word daddy.
Right.
And so he, you know, he worked very hard for all of us, you know, to get as healthy as he could. And we all did. We all chipped in for a while. But, you know, there's no denying you go through that really dark period of,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you're working. You want so much to get back to where you were. You think that's the only place you can be, like you said, that period at the end of the sentence. And it's a great way to put it. And, but, you know, once we did start, you know, he went back into rehab and worked really hard. And then he was discharged from physical therapy first, and he was bored. So we had a gym membership, and I called a friend that I knew, a young guy who worked out to help him swim and everything, and he worked out with Hugh, and that was great. And we really found that the more he cross-trained physically, the more mentally fit he became. His memory, his stamina, his attention span, all of those things improved with exercise. And so that became a big part of our program, you know, our personal thing was after he would do his rehab for speech therapy and cognitive therapy, we always did something physical. We would go for long walks around the block. We would go to the gym and things like that. And so that, I think, really made a difference for him. But he eventually, at 9 months out, he took a driving test at HealthSouth. You know, he, according to him, not being able to drive was like the worst side effect of all.
Well,
yeah. Car keys so bad. And I had sold a car right after he was hurt because I knew he wouldn't drive for a long time. And we had two cars, and I was worried about money. And, you know, he got his license back after 9 months. And then 10 months out, 1 month later, he had a seizure.
Oh, no.
And he had his first grand mal seizure, and they took his license away. And that was really upsetting. And so that was another setback.
Mm-hmm.
And they pull your license for 6 months until you can go through the whole, medicine
right.
and everything else. And so he got through that, and he continued in therapy. And eventually he became stronger cognitively and physically. And just shy of the 2-year anniversary, I don't know if you want me to spoil the end of the book.
No.
Don't put any spoilers in there.
No, I think somebody asked earlier, why don't we just say, because we are coming up on the hour, and I want some callers to have the opportunity to call in and ask some questions. But
sure.
But Hugh did wind up working again.
He does. He works full-time, yes.
He works full-time now. That was one of the questions I saw in the chat room earlier. So how long would you say that I'll ask the first question, and then callers queue up if you'd like to call in and ask Rosemary any questions. Our call-in number is 424-243-9540. Again, that's 424-243-9540. And you can go ahead and call in, press 1, and I'll be with you in just a moment. I see those question marks in the chat room. You just call in and ask those questions. Okay, so how long then was Hugh in therapy?
How long was he in therapy? In all therapies?
Yeah, till he was all finished.
It was probably 13 months, 14 months. 14 mm-hmm. months probably, because he was in cognitive therapy long after physical therapy. He finished occupational and physical therapy first, and then he stayed in speech therapy for a very long time, which was really the cognitive work.
Right.
And that was to work on memory, attention, concentration, all different types of that sort of thing. And we did run out of funds, but, you know, I paid for some out of pocket. I negotiated prices. I cut back on the number of visits and did cognitive work at home. The therapist gave me homework to do at home.
Ah,
so
good.
We were very active.
I bet. Now, the cognitive therapies, tell me just a little bit about that. These are things they never thought to send me to. It wasn't as obvious for a while, but did those therapies, they must have obviously helped some, or you wouldn't have gone on with them. But as far as the memory and the focus and that sort of thing, did you notice a marked difference?
Yes, I did. There were a couple of things that made a big difference. He participated in something that was new at the time, and now I think it's pretty common. It was called metronome therapy.
Yes. Oh,
and
now I know we'll get a caller.
Yes.
Okay.
And he hated it. He hated that therapy. He thought it was absolute. He just hated doing it. It was so difficult for him. But he made great strides from that therapy. Interactive metronome, it's called.
Yeah. DJ just popped up with that in the chat room. So I wondered. DJ, did you have that therapy? DJ was in an accident where he hit his head working on a rig on a boat. His head was hit on a bridge and had his traumatic brain injury. And he's our resident scientist. He's got all the terminology and the quickest keys in the planet when it comes to looking up some of the technical things that we need to know about sometimes. And he came
right
up with the interactive metronome. All I know of a metronome is from music. I've got an old antique metronome that my grandpa had on top of the piano, the grandpa that you read about, when my mom's younger brothers, when I used to spend the night over there, they had to play piano, and I remember that old wooden metronome on top of the piano. I used to, in fact, I think my mom still has that. I always liked that as a kid, moving the little thing up and down and making it go quicker or slower.
Right, right. Well, and it's kind of similar to that. He would wear headphones, and he would, and they would play. They would have the metronome sound and a kind of rhythm, and he would have to tap his feet, like in sync with the rhythm. And you know, Hugh actually never really liked to dance and never had much rhythm.
Yeah, so. I was gonna say there's a lot of guys that wouldn't do well on that, who wouldn't have had a brain injury. I grew up in the disco era. I could name quite a few, half the dance
right.
floor needed that metronome therapy for Pete's sake. I'm sorry, white boys in the room.
But he, you know, he just didn't like it. But he knew it was it helped him. And
yeah.
And then the other things they did were, you know, it was a lot of worksheets, a lot of looking things up and problem solving, and it got more and more complicated as it went on.
Like
and,
school. You know, the girls were
like
in school. It was like being in school. He had his homework too.
Right, right. And, yeah, and then we had friends come and, you know, he had a former boss actually came over and worked on the computer with him and things like that. But, you know, he worked very hard. I have to say, he had a saying that was, if it's to be, it's up to me. And he would say that all the time, like to inspire himself and, you know, and try to make it happen. He wanted so much for it to happen, and he did. He succeeded. I'm very proud of him.
If it's to be, not for me. That's really great.
Yeah.
That's really great. So how does he feel about things now, in as much as you can speak for him? And then how do you feel about things now? And then we'll just see if there's any callers. It's been a really incredible story, and she's got an incredible book. I'm going to have one of you, I'm going to go ahead and put that site in again. So how's he feeling at this point, Rosemary?
He feels great. He is back to riding his bike and surfing, and he's very athletic again, and the riding the bike part scares me to death.
I bet.
It does. But, you know, actually the doctors have helped me out with that. I mean, they even, you know, one of the big themes in the book is that you can't go through life being afraid of everything. And I really did get to a point where I was fearful. And, and you know, I worked on that. And he actually, in some ways, I think, you know, I think he's healthier than I am in some ways. He just has moved on. He doesn't let TBI define him at all. He just goes about his life. He's working. He's, you know, very happy.
Mm-hmm.
And we both are. I mean, our relationship is very strong. He is on the board of the Brain Injury Association of Virginia now. He works with them.
Really?
And sometimes we give talks together. And I'm working with the TBI model system at Virginia Commonwealth University on their advisory board. So we both, you know, stay active in the community and try to, try to help as many people as we can with any of our past experience. One thing I really wished I had was a mentor. And it's like what you said, you didn't know anybody who'd been through what you'd been through.
Right. Right.
I think it is so helpful that people share their stories because it really does make people feel less isolated. They get
mm-hmm.
more information. You know, they might have ideas for treatments and things like that, and it can be very helpful.
It really, you know, I've said that time and time again, that I've learned more in the last year since my book came out than I knew in the 17 years prior to that. From the medical community and not having ever met any other survivor or had any kind of support group around here. It blows me away, you know, the year of 2012 in particular, and then going into this year, you know, how my journey really unfolded and just split, you know, the road just split with that book and took me down a totally different road, you know, than
right.
Who would have known, you know, not me when I, you know, when
well,
I was
and now
writing.
You're basically an inspiration to many, many people. And I know my husband is an inspiration to a lot of people too. You know, just when we go to Hell South and he meets people and, you know, he'll say, I was where you were, I was feeling the way you were feeling for a while, you know, but things do improve. You'll find your way. And people need to hear that again and again.
Exactly. I think that's one of the things we're wanting to do with the peer hotline that's going to be coming, you know, in a couple of weeks. And
mm-hmm.
and there's also a mentor program involved with that. So, you know, we're trying to get out there and do our part as well. But that was one of the questions earlier in the chat room, too, and you answered it. So, yes, they're both, Rosemary and Hugh, are very active in carrying the TBI message and being involved. So
mm-hmm.
Is there anybody out there who has any questions? I see people on the chat board, nobody with their hand up right now. Rosemary is on the East Coast, so I'm not going to keep her much longer. But just for a couple minutes, if you don't mind, Rosemary.
No, not at all.
This is our Tuesday night host, Les Paul, and he's huge on music therapy. He's the one when you said the metronome that I thought would probably
ding, ding,
call
ding.
In. Rosemary, this is Les. Les, Rosemary.
Hi,
ding,
Les.
Ding, ding. I am the music metronome. I'm kidding with you. Nice to hear you. And a lot of what you said made me think back to when my mother had to care for me for so long. I mean, talking about you caregiving him reminded me a lot of what my mother told me about me when she, my mother told me it aged her 10 years when she saw what I went through. And so I'm going to mention something else for a few seconds. I went to a conference at the Brain Injury Association of America about 5 years ago now, and it was called Caring for the Caregiver. And one of the things that the first presenter said, walks out in the room, how dare you? You should be ashamed of yourself. I can't believe you. You should be ashamed of yourself. And people are saying, well, what's this person talking about? I can't believe they're talking. And there's a huge room full of people, and there are a lot of moms and dads out there of brain injury survivors. And she goes, yes, I'm speaking to you. How dare you? You don't take any time to even check your own blood pressure. You don't go to bed on time. You're always caring for your son, your child, your mom or your dad, whoever's had the brain injury, and you forget mm-hmm. to take care of yourself. You might have sugar diabetes or you might have a heart attack because you're not taking care of yourself. And it was based
right.
on that. And it was a wonderful
conference.
Yes,
that's conference. Very true. That's very
did
true.
Did you have a hard time with that?
Yeah, I did. I did. I actually thought I went to the doctor once because I thought I was having a heart attack. And the doctor told me I had a broken heart.
Oh,
I
imagine
know.
You did.
Yeah.
But, I think you're exactly right. Caregivers don't find the time to take care of themselves.
And so I'm super thankful for you being on tonight. Kim, you got another wonderful guest. And I mean, she was just hitting so many things. It made me think back. My mother's passed away. She was my primary caregiver. When I left the hospital, I had no in-home therapy other than my mother.
Wow.
And I was in the hospital 3 months, and I don't even remember coming home and the 3 or 4 months following that. So they were told that your son is pretty much going to be non-functional for the rest of his life and not know anybody, not know where he's at. My mother wouldn't give up on me.
Wow. And listen, you sound wonderful.
And that's the amazing part. I mean, She brought into me the karaoke. I'm not going to say much about it, Kim, because I've mentioned it so many times. And when you said metronome therapy, I talk about that a lot of times on these shows because it resets the brain. It recalibrates it.
Yes. Okay. Well, I didn't even realize that. That makes perfect sense. That must be what it does.
It's like retiming your brain clock, or like a drummer. If you've ever watched someone just practicing on the drums. Boom, 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 like the beat of your heart.
Right.
When I went to the Music Therapy Association of America's conference, they had us all put our hand on our heart. And then a man on bongos was going boom, boom, boom. Then start going boom, boom, boom on your chest. And
right.
They said, now pick up the rhythm of your heart, and it will start timing your brain, and then it'll help the clock in your brain start working better.
Isn't
after
that amazing?
There, it helped me so much.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's
it was
great.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, I know metronome therapy helped you a lot, so I do highly recommend it.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, that's great. Les Paul, we have another caller. I'll just keep you on the line if you want to hang on.
Okay.
We will let on area code 724. You're on the air. Who do we have?
Hi, Kim. This is Tracy. Hi, Rosemary.
Tracy.
Hi, Tracy. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I have enjoyed this show tremendously. Well, it's great to hear your voice. I'm just so delighted.
You
touched on a lot of things that I went through as a sibling 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, getting your message out for the industry is so important. I know I wrote back 20 years ago in 1993, actually, I wrote to, they were doing research on what family members go through down in the University of New Orleans when I took over guardianship, and I volunteered to be part of the research. And I wrote a letter to the Dr. Roki Osami about what my family had gone through, which is kind of the opposite of what yours did. But that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was interesting. I wrote to him, and I said that in brain injury, it either brings a family closer together or it tears them apart. And in our instance, it tore us apart, and we got split up all over the actually, my younger brother at 14, well, he was 14 and I was 16. Steve was sent to Canada boarding schools, and I was catapulted to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to live with cousins.
Oh, wow.
And we lost all of our, each of us. But then we had lost our mother 4 years prior to that.
Wow.
And my dad had to retire from United Airlines as a pilot, and he at the age of 50. And, we just went through, trauma after trauma after trauma. But, it was interesting because Dr. Roki Osami wrote back to me, and he said, he wrote me a letter, and I still have it. And he asked to read the letter I wrote to him, which I wish I had. We didn't have computers where you could type things off and save them at that, or at least I didn't in 93. And but he asked to read my letter to his classes in the university. And it was interesting because I found him on the Internet. He's now teaching out in California at a university for rehabilitation and disability. And I contacted him, and I sent him his letter. I scanned it, and he was like, and then I forwarded him a bunch of emails and all the stuff I've been going through over the last 6 years in the industry. And he wrote back, he said, oh, my God. He said, what I see here is a lot of spirit. And
yeah.
He said, may I read your emails to my classes out here?
Well, As a caregiver, you're so equal parts strength and complete neuroticism.
Oh, exactly. Oh, I'm as neurotic as can be. No,
well,
he's a beautiful man.
I definitely have.
Yeah, I've been there, and at times, and it's really been a journey, and hearing your journey is just beautiful. I want to thank you. It's interesting because Dr. Roki Osami and I have hooked up on LinkedIn, and he has to be a friend on Facebook. So we kind of keep in touch in some ways.
Oh, that's great.
Where I've come from, it sort of pushed me into looking for alternatives in treatment of brain injury because I've been in the industry for 45 years.
Right.
And the metronome thing is just. I met another doctor, Eastern Pennsylvania, over the last that my doctor sent me to, that does a program. It's called acupuncture for the mind, and he's got a program for brain injury, but I couldn't get it into medical. you know, I tried hooking him up to medical, and they poo-pooed
uh-huh.
it. But,
right.
And I even got the guy to do, you know, I asked him if he would do a free trial to see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very willing to do this. But, you know, it's maybe too out of the box at this point. But,
yeah, there's
you know,
a lot
I've been
of things
for...
coming up the pike, I think. A lot of,
yeah.
I just saw on Brainline, and I guess it's being used in the military, some kind of a sensor for your tongue, your tongue has so many direct lines right into your brain, apparently, which I'm not saying this scientifically because I don't really know how, but it's on Brainline now, and I think that's something that they're talking about bringing into the mainstream.
Interesting.
And there are several new drugs coming on too, but it is hard, Tracy. It's just to stay on top of everything, and it's hard to get some of the holistic types of treatments sometimes to get them paid for, and really they can be so helpful.
Well, it is. Yeah, I had gotten a massage therapy from my brother here in Pittsburgh through his physiatrist, and you know, Dr. Franz, to me, he was with my brother for 13 years, and we had a great relationship, absolutely wonderful, and you know, he was very supportive of me and Mike, and I'm very grateful to him. So I had gotten, and the insurance company, you know, went for it. But, of course, you know, the case manager who the insurance companies hire, they try to cut costs, you know, and they say, well, we'll only pay for this, you know. And I got him into chiropractor therapy, you know, years
mm-hmm.
ago. And then the chiropractor actually started doing innovative laser stuff. I couldn't tell you what it was. That was 6-7 years ago. But he was also doing physical therapy with Mike, and I got him into physical therapy. I had to get an independent nutritionist because the facility, the facility where he was at was suffering from major malnutrition and dehydration, and I had gotten two nutritional therapists to come in over the span of 2 years, and they still didn't do what they were supposed to do. And he just deteriorated phenomenally over 11 years because of their lack of care. And
so disturbing. Yeah.
You know, the problem is that I found, and it's not always the case, but, you know, when you're a big advocate for a loved one and they're not doing the job, it takes everything out of you. And it's not the brain injury in my brother's instance. It's not the brain injury that he was going through or recovering from. It was a lack of care.
Right,
and,
right.
And, you know, I found this in so many different – my brother's been all over the country, and probably – he's been moved probably about 13 times because of this. And but that's also his brain injury because he's very extensively, you know, had major damage, I guess you would say. I hate to say damage because I don't like that word.
I know. I don't either.
You know.
Right.
Alterations,
but even at that, you know, you know, the experiences that we went through, you know, is bringing me, well, yeah, I'm going to fight for people's rights here. And,
right.
You know, I'm here to, you know, I think that's what my mission is, to find alternatives at what works. And I really think love is one of the major healers out there.
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
I think
definitely.
For everything, right?
Yeah, and
I think
the
you're
success,
right, Tracy. Ultimately,
yeah.
I think a blended approach, you know, to medicine would be nice. They're, I couldn't believe it when you said, and I've got to take another caller real quick, but I couldn't believe it that you got the body work approved. I'd really love to do that. That's costing me a fortune. That's the only thing I get to work.
Well, my stepmother, who was she was in the mental retardation as a teacher. She got the insurance company to pay for dental because Mike could not brush his teeth properly, and he's probably the first one and the only in the country that got that with the insurance company to pay for it.
That's so.
But
I
then,
bet.
Yeah,
the
then
power
the last,
of advocacy,
the last,
right? Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I know. But then the facility that he was in prior to moving him this last time, they didn't never took him to a dentist. And I was sick at the time for many years, and I wasn't on top of things, and he lost the majority of his teeth because they did
oh,
not
wow.
take him to a dentist for 11 years. And
wow.
I had, well, a lot of you know my history.
Yeah.
But at any rate, you know, I am, my health is in very good shape now. And I got back into really being an advocate for my brother, and that really got me in trouble. Because I'm one of these in-your-face type people, you know.
Right.
Joan of Arc, you know, on her horse.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's, I'm learning in the process still after 45
right.
years. So, but anyway, I'll let you take this extra, you know, this next
call.
Right.
Well,
thank you
so
again,
much.
Rosemary. This is just beautiful. Thank you so much. And enjoy the storm down in Richmond.
I know
yeah.
we are.
There's a joke about that with me in Richmond, so I'll tell you something.
Right.
I'll email you.
Okay.
All right, Tracy, thank you so much for everything.
Oh, well, thank you, Kim.
Yeah.
And everybody from Brain Injury Radio. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, I do want to remind people, I am going to let Rosemary go. I'm going to take your call, Frank, so don't go anywhere. We have 10 more minutes in the show. I just wanted to say if anyone wants to stay for the overtime, we'll be playing some music in overtime, but you need to call in because the live callers, the callers, will drop off who haven't dialed in 10 minutes. So you need to call in to 424-243-9540 to make sure that you'll be able to stay online. And again, we want to thank our sponsor, Gordon Johnson. Gordon Johnson, I'm sorry, TBILaw.com. And I'm going to take a call. Frank, we've got about 5 minutes, 5 minutes for you, and then I'm going to thank Rosemary. She's on the East Coast like you, and let her get to bed. Hopefully she's sleeping better these days. Frank, welcome.
No Ambien.
Yeah, good. This is Frank, I think. Is it Frank? Area code 585, you're on the line. Is it snowing in New York?
It might be. I think the storm's heading up there.
Ah, okay. Well, Frank, I've got your mic unmuted, but we're not hearing you. If this is Frank, or otherwise it's someone else in area code 585.
It's me. Thank you, Kim.
Oh, okay.
Until it was late. Is Rosemary still on the show?
Yes. Hello, Frank. How are you?
Fantastic. Now, Rosemary, I have a book. I didn't get into almost an hour was in the show. Have you written a book?
Yes. I've written a book called Learning by Accident.
That's a title. I'm trying to get a list of everybody who has written a book. I'm going to have a woman on my morning show tomorrow morning who has written a book, a poetry book.
Wonderful.
Cool. Writing is a really cathartic way to work through what ails you. We really recommend it. And Frank, I did put into the chat room, and I'll be happy to tell you if you don't catch it in the chat, but you can go to her website, Rosemary Rollins. It tells you where to buy the book and all that stuff if you want to see it.
I'm not in the chat room. I'm downstairs. I just had a call from my business partner, Stan. He just called me up, which is why I didn't get on the call earlier.
That's okay, Frank. You know us. We've got archives. Come back on demand and listen to the show. It was a great show, but I'll be happy to send you the information on Rosemary's book. Today we did the other side of the coin instead of a survivor. Well, we still had a survivor story, but we heard it from the perspective of the caregiver. So without going through
That's
the whole show
great.
Again, since we just got a few more minutes,
Yeah, yeah. I hope you'll listen in the archive. Rosemary's been a very gracious guest and, you know, helped us all understand what it was like for the people in our lives while we were going through what we were going through with our brain injuries, what it was like to be a loved one watching it and experiencing it from their end. So, Rosemary, I really want to thank you so much for being on the show tonight. And Frank, if you have something further, I'll let you say it, but I want to make sure I've got time here to thank Rosemary for being on the show and sharing her experience, strength, and hope with us. I hope you guys will check out her book, Learning by Accident. I've just typed her website into the chat room, but it's rosemaryrawlins.com. That's R-A-W-L-I-N-S, rosemaryrawlins.com. Brainline.org is a really cool information site, and she's been writing a caregiver's blog on there. Be sure to check that out. And the book. But anyway, Rosemary, thank you so much for coming on my show tonight and sharing your story. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Kim, and for everything that you do and for getting the word out to everyone. It's so important, and it's such great work. And thanks to all the callers who called in. I appreciate that.
As a parting shot, since we've gotten this part done and I've got like 2 minutes, what would you say, and maybe Paul kind of hit on it with you earlier, but what would you say as a person who's been through what you've been through, if someone were about to be in a caretaking position, what would be the first most important thing you'd tell them that would be helpful?
I think I would say that the very best thing you can do, and it's very difficult to do, is to truly take one day at a time and allow things to unfold, because it says right on the back of my book that fear is more debilitating than any illness or injury. And I think we get ourselves so worked up over things that, you know, some things don't even materialize, and worry, you know, it's just a terrible thing to carry around with you day and night. So as best you can, find ways to cope and manage stress and go through one day at a time. And it's so much easier said than done. So, and I truly know that from experience.
Oh, yes, yes, but, you certainly do. But even as a survivor, you know, fear sometimes is the absence of faith. And, you know, when I pray anymore, I don't really pray for specifics. I pray for the strength and courage to be able to meet life on life's terms with some amount of grace. And
exactly, and to try to, you know, be in that moment with the person who's injured. If you're sitting there just completely in a panic state, you can't be present with that person.
Right.
And I think it's very important to connect, connect with your loved one right in the here and now. And, you know, like Tracy said, love is a very wonderful healer. So I think it is a truly wonderful healer, just like I was mentioning about the kids with Hugh. So,
right.
You know, just taking every day, one day at a time, and being present as much as you can. It's a hard thing to do, but it can be done.
Well, thank you so much, Rosemary. I've got to close the show in the usual way. Thanks again for being my guest, and we all appreciate you being here. I'm going to close the show with something I believe we all have, and I think Rosemary would agree. This is Guardian Angel, Guardian Angel by Leah West. I encourage you to check out her website too, leahwest.com. This is Guardian Angel. For those staying, we'll see you on the other side of the hour. For those of you who attended and are leaving, thanks so much for being here and sharing the evening with Brain Injury Radio, Kim and Rosemary. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Got a plan. Yes, it's your time to leave. But don't you worry, you won't be there alone. You see, there's someone who's been waiting for you.
Okay, that's rolled us over into the other side of the hour with overtime. I'm going to unmute all of the mics for everybody who's on the line now. And so, okay, all of your mics are unmuted. Thank you guys for being here tonight. Did you enjoy Rosemary?
Fantastico.
It was great.
Wonderful. Thank you, Kim.
Oh, thank you, Tracy. Yes, Tracy is actually the one that told me about Rosemary. So I appreciate
that.
Well,
I met her. Yeah, I was interested. I met her online on LinkedIn. And ironically, she lives in the same town as my brother does.
Oh, really?
Synchronicity at plus, you know. She does. She's not clued in on my journey down there. But anyway, I got to know her and then hooked up with her on Facebook and I checked her website out. Well, I was scouting around for people that would be wonderful for this radio program and she was just a beautiful. She's just beautiful. You know, and her
whole
journey.
She really is.
You know, she was apologizing to me how, you know, she knew a little bit of what I've gone through and she was so sorry about it. And I said, don't be, you know, it's been a blessing to me because it's taken me to where I'm at today. And even though our journeys are on the complete opposite ends of the pole, you know, there's still a reason and a blessing for all of it. And, you know, I think people, stories like hers are so inspiring for families to hold together, to be there for the person. And, you know, and then also to, you know, when you look at my history, you know, we got lost. So that sent us all down roads of some of them no return. You know, I'm still here, but no one else is. And, you know, it's just really pretty interesting how life, you know, the journeys that ones go, you know, what people go through. So it also, you know, based on what I've gone through, it shows the importance of what we do need for healing and recovery. And, you know, so that's just beautiful. I'm just so delighted. Thank you so much, Kim.
Oh, thank you.
Really.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it was really, really timely. I mean, we booked the show weeks ago, and I just found out today my dad's going to be having back surgery a week from tomorrow.
Oh,
and with Parkinson's, it's really ill-advised.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting. I'd find that out today and have my first caregiver guest on tonight. It was just one of those things that seems to happen a lot in my life. And so, you know, it was neat, the metronome and all of that. I'll be tapping you guys and probably her on the shoulder. I think that's one of the problems they see in putting Parkinson's patients under, and that's getting the brain to come back and function the way that it's supposed to. And I'm hoping we've got some metronome therapy and some of the other things DJ was talking about that I can suggest or try to get to help him get better, you know.
Yeah, that's going to be. When is that coming up next week?
A week from tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, just found out.
Keep you all in our prayers. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Thanks. I wish.
Kim,
yes.
Are you going to be able to do your show a week from tomorrow or not?
Well, I'm on Wednesday, so yes, I'll be able to do that. They say he'll be in the, well, now, you know, it's really hard to tell. You never really know, do you? But they said he'll be in the hospital for 3 days, and then he's going to have to go to a rehab facility for some amount of time, undetermined at this point. But I would think by this time of night, I'm probably generally going to be home. If I need a sub, I'll let one of you guys know well ahead of time. But the surgery is not till a week from tomorrow, which would be Friday. So I do have a guest on next week and planning on being here. And as far as I know, I'm always planning on being here, but I'll give someone some notice And if not one of our regulars, you know, somebody like DJ or Keith Anthony, who doesn't do a show every week, might be able to pop in. Or I've even, I haven't talked to him again yet, but I started talking to that James Larkin Smith, who was in the chat room tonight. He was on as a guest of mine one night, and he has his own radio show by day and is familiar with Blog Talk Radio. And we've talked before about having some additional hosts to be able to do pinch hitting for any of us, you know, if we need to be away. So this might be the time to
tell him to phone up
on the studio, you know, and just in case. But it's you know, it's 9 o'clock my time when the show starts, so I would think a lot. I'll be home a lot of that time, but we'll see. We'll see. I don't know. We've been, you know, I wish my mom would have had. You know, if there would have been a caregiver group, or she would have gotten involved with something like that, that would be of help to her right now. I mean, I'm scared and nervous too, but I understand powerlessness, and I'm going to try really hard not to let my vibrations off onto my dad, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
I want to be able to be there to be present for him and supportive for him. And I know that when I was fresh out of brain surgery, there was a lot of anxiety around me, and that gave me a lot of anxiety. You know what I mean. You know, I was already anxious. And
if I interrupt you, don't you have a TBI support group in your town?
No, that's one of the things I've been saying since the beginning, is there wasn't one in 1995, and there's not one now. Never happened.
Shame.
Well, the reason I ask is if you have an independent living group or something like that, there has to be some caregivers in your town, because when I go to my, I go to two different strokes. I go to a stroke support group meeting. I go to a TBI meeting once every 2 weeks here in Rochester, and they have caregivers. They break us off to caregivers and survivors.
Yeah, that's what Sarah was saying they do in her town in Delaware.
I know they do every place, and I can't believe that you have to move someplace, don't you?
Well, actually, and it's not even, there's almost a million people in this city. And in fact, we've got a huge transplant center. Robert Redford's son came here for his liver transplant at the University of Nebraska Med Center.
Wow.
We're kind of a well-known cancer treatment facility here. Not like some that you've heard, but definitely the transplant center and some of their cancer treatment programs are some of the finest in the country. But, you know, to be honest, when it comes to the caregiving part of things, I guess I'm going to be learning on the job, because even though my dad has had Parkinson's for a few years, he's been ambulatory, you know what I mean? There's things that I've known. I haven't been overly concerned, because he's been able to get around and drive, and things I know that are really upsetting to him, I've known that, you know, some days you're as good as you're going to be, you know what I mean? And this thing with his leg, his back that came up, it was a sporadic thing for a while, and it really isn't his back. He's not feeling it in his lower back. It resembles to me like a sciatica kind of pain. It shoots down, you know, the back of his leg, one of his legs.
Yeah.
And when you're not real steady on your feet anyway, and then now all the time, it's been like a month or a month and a half where it's been relentless, continuous pain whenever he puts his foot down. And he can't get in a comfortable position, which he was able for a while, you know, to maybe shift a little bit or stand or sit and shake it out. And that just hasn't been happening. So for the last month and a half, we've been trying all of the, and my parents, Trace, aren't big on trying alternative therapies. They're trusting traditional medicine. So, of course, they've thrown a lot of pills at it that haven't worked.
Yeah, sure.
He's had all the
I was just thinking, Parkinson's. Parkinson's, in all the, you know, research I've done on nutrition and stuff, David Wolf, the raw food guru, you know, brought up macuna. Have you heard of that? An herb that in India they use that. And he had tried this on a, someone that came to one of his conferences, and within 15 minutes, this woman stopped shaking. And
wow.
They use it in India. It's spelled macuna. I'll have to email it to you.
Yeah, do that.
I'll message
really
it to you.
Great.
Yeah, they use it in Ayurvedic medicine, and it actually it also helps elevate the mood. And all it is an herb, I think, and I do use it myself in my smoothies and on occasion. Now, the brand I have is not your higher quality blend, so it tastes horrible, but you can buy good stuff. But, you know, all this stuff is expensive. You know?
Oh, God, yes. I was going to say, it can really break you trying to live a healthy lifestyle. When I switched from our local supermarket to Whole Foods and Trader Joe's, man, I could feel it in the pocketbook every month.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, Whole Foods is known as Whole Paycheck.
Yes, exactly.
So I only buy certain things down there and try to buy the organics at local and then hit the farmers markets. And
yeah,
I can't
afford to do all my shopping there. You're
but I do a lot of shopping online. Yeah, I buy all my supplements online pretty much, except for Vitamin Shop. I can get stuff there, and we have a local store. So I go there to get my flax oil and coconut oil and that kind of stuff because I can get it cheaper there. So I've been, you know, shopping around for the best deals I can find online.
Sure. Well, yeah, why not? We've got it.
Yeah.
We've got it now.
It really
why not
is.
Try it?
Yeah. So, you know, but traditional medicine, you know, they shy away from that stuff because that's not what they're taught. And hopefully, you know, this is, well, they're trying to squash the alternatives. I mean, they're really trying to fight that and fight supplements. Oh, yeah. But they're not going to win. No doubt that this is, you know, I think we've come into a time where they have to embrace the alternatives and have the medical and alternative work together. And, you know, I think that is coming eventually. In our lifetime, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about our lifetime, but I mean, I think people are catching on, you know, that the fastest segment of drug dealer population is the medical profession these days.
Right,
it's not
about
on the,
that.
It's not on the street corner in the hood anymore. They've gotten trounced by pharmaceuticals and traditional medicine, and you can tell. You know, I said it talking about, depression. There's a unrelated support group that I go to, and you could probably point and go, Cymbalta Prestique, Cymbalta Prestique, you know, and go through the room, and it's, you know, and before it was Celexa, and what was the other one, but it was those
Lexapro's
two.
Lexapro's now the
Yeah,
the
that's it,
one.
Lexapro, Celexa, yeah. Lexapro,
well,
Celexa.
You know, yeah, it's interesting, you know, how these drugs have developed, and they really... you know, of course, you know my stand on that, and you know there is a, you know there are some drugs are necessary, unless you can find an alternative. Now the psychiatric drugs, I don't know, I have a bad taste in my mouth for that.
Yeah,
but even the anti seizure drugs, you know, I've looked for alternatives for that, and Dr. McCullough. I don't know if you know him. He's a big guy on the internet with alternatives, and he's a medical doctor in Chicago. And I know him, and we kind of had a falling out at one time, but he and his girlfriend are friends of mine. But, you know, I asked him, you know, do you have, he had a post recently on the anticonvulsants, and I asked him, I said, is there an alternative out there to prevent seizures? Now, I know years ago, did you ever watch the movie? There was a movie, and this is what started me off on my whole healing journey for my own self. There was a, Meryl Streep was in a movie, and it was about epilepsy. And it was called, at first, something like Cause No Harm, or At First Cause No Harm. And it was a true story about a mother and her son who had epilepsy. And they discovered a diet that was similar to the Atkins diet. And they did research at Johns Hopkins University, and she somehow got her son on it and cured him. And in most of the film, there's like 30 people in the film that were actors that were recovered people on this diet from epilepsy. But it doesn't always work. So, but that I watched that film, and it was about nutrition. And there's also that movie Lorenzo's Oil that came out. That was a fabulous film. You know, so there is stuff out there that we're discovering. And even Johns Hopkins just posted, this was just recently, about diet and lack of, you know, controlling stress for cancer. And saying, you know, they were actually saying that's better treatment than the treatments that they have. So medical is catching on, and this is good to see.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm sure something will come up, you know.
Well, I think they'll have a more integrative medical approach because people are going to, you know, eventually realize what a lot of us have here, and that's, you know, and again, we're, for the audience that's listening, we're not medical professionals, and there is a need for some pharmaceuticals, certainly, but at the same time, I think they're over-prescribed, and a lot of things are prescribed for other things than what they're meant for, and it's kind of a two-pronged problem, because the other side of it is, if you know, that seems to be the first line of defense in traditional medicine, and with, you know, our healthcare system changing so that they can only spend 2.5 minutes with each patient to run 59,000 through each day, you know, there's not a lot of time to be doing anything else but whipping out the pad, you know, and I think that the other side of that problem is that I wish they would do like with cigarettes and have them make them quit being able to advertise on TV, because I think that people have issues out there and they see some of those commercials and they just hear the first part of it. You know, they don't hear the part they say real fast in the small print afterwards, you know. But, you know, are you feeling blue? Like the one I really liked, I think it was Prestique, but it showed the little wind-up girl doll. It just showed her running out of steam, you know. She was wound up, and then her ticker started going down. And as her ticker started going down, she's starting to, like, fall over. And who hasn't felt exhausted like that, right? You know? So only half the world. And so how many people saw that commercial and ran in, you know, to say, I need this. Yeah, this is me, you know. And,
well, I think it's our culture, you know, that see, I don't watch TV, so I miss all that. And I purposely don't watch it for a long time because, to me, it's brainwashing the public. But people are taught to look outside themselves for fixes and answers and I'm talking about the general public, when the answers truly are within yourself. But we're taught to run to our doctor to fix me, you know, and we're taught to run to, you know, anywhere to fix me. When, you know, we do have the power, as you all know, to heal yourself. You know, I mean, all these stories coming out, you know, you're proving it. Less. I mean, look what you've done.
I'd like to share a quick something related to what you're talking about. Today I watched Dr. Oz, and I haven't seen him in quite a while. I like you said, I don't watch much television anymore. And I just,
yeah.
I noticed something he said caught my ear, and he was talking about the not just medication, but medical treatments such as radiation, and he was talking about biopsies and all kinds of different tests that literally, if you look 10 years down the road, they either didn't help, which could be, they were talking about breast cancer, they were talking about colon cancer, prostate. And
yeah,
he's saying some of these tests that they've discovered, the body can actually heal itself. And when you go in the body, they said it can sometimes make it spread by doing that and make it
worse. He's
going through a long list of ones that he recommended, and some he said he would shy away from. And so be very conscious consumer about your own health.
Well, that's
I don't have any doubt. That's true.
Yeah.
You know, you go in and disturb something like that, you know, that it's going to spread. A couple of years ago, we had huge flooding around here. It had never been seen in 100 years. And people started having, I mean, the flood was here. It took a long time for the floodwaters to recede, you know, and things to get fixed, months and months and months and months. And there was so much stuff we're used to seeing that was underground, and when that cleared up the next year, people who had never had allergies before were having horrible, and still are having terrible allergies, developing sicknesses that they had never had before. And you know, one of the theories, and I think it's true, and it parallels, it's kind of an analogy for what you're talking about, Les Paul, is that you know, the ground had been tamped down for all those years, for 100 years, that ground had been tamped down tight, and then all of a sudden that water, you know, tons of water sat on top of it for
almost
a year. Yeah, it disturbed the ground. And all of the stuff that had been buried for 100 years, when everything dried up then, you know, it got it loose while the water was in there for almost a year.
Wow.
And then when things dried up, all of that disturbed ground and the toxins that had been inside of it that were laying there got blown through the air, and all of a sudden people were getting sick with things they had never had before, particularly allergy and respiratory things. And I think, you know, when some things are better left encapsulated and undisturbed, you know, than going in and poking and prodding you know, it's like if you put ketchup in a balloon, you know, and you pop the balloon, you know, what's going to happen? So...
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, the whole thing about practicing medicine. I mean, there's two sides of that coin. You know, when I had my surgery, that micro-neurosurgical techniques were relatively new. You know, that clip procedure was relatively new, like with you. And, you know, for that, it was great. It saved our life. They didn't know what the long-term effects of that were going to be, but it turns out that, you know, those clips seem to be holding up good. You know, I'm 18 years down the road and you know, sitting here to tell about it. So certainly, you know, technology can be a really good thing, but it changes, you know, when they learn more. I think there's 4 new ways to treat aneurysms that weren't around when we were having our first ones. You know, a couple of them are only 2 years old. You know, one of them is the Onyx treatment, and I was reading about that, and all I could visualize was crazy glue. And that's basically what they're doing. You know, instead of clipping it or coiling it, they're going in with a clear glue and gluing it off.
Wow.
Who knows?
I rarely hear my treatment mentioned anymore. It was new and groundbreaking when they did it on me. They said I wouldn't have survived without it, and that's called embolization. And I don't hear it mentioned that much, but they do still do it.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
Well, there's a great need for medical, but there's also a great need for changes too.
Yes.
And newer stuff is coming out in medical, so we'll see what that brings. Like you said, we live in a. I think we live in a fabulous time right now of transformation and change and a higher consciousness of in many aspects of our world. And the TBI industry is just one little segment of it, but it's a major segment.
And I see,
you know, my vision, and what I'm seeing is really the changes that will be coming and that are coming now through all of you and through people like Rosemary and the websites like brainline.org and there's a lot of websites out there and a lot of groups forming and all of this is good progress. I'm seeing just a beautiful things happening, and that's the energy I want to see.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
When I was here in Pittsburgh, with my brother's journey, the people that took care of my brother, they were affiliated with all the brain injury organizations and national organizations, and I didn't get any support from them. I didn't get anything, but I didn't have a computer back then, and I was never invited to. They would have monthly or yearly picnics at the facility or this organization that he was affiliated with, and I was never invited to the picnics. I was never invited to anything, and. It's really amazing. And I was thinking about what you had said, Kim, at a recent program about asking about medical doctors. Why the national organization are they bringing this stuff to medical doctors? In hospitals and stuff. They've been around for these organizations have been around for over 20 years, and we're now asking that question. After 20 years, the stuff that they spend all this money on brochures and education, why hasn't this been in medical? Why didn't we see this?
It's disheartening, I guess. It's good.
Yeah.
We want to work cooperatively with the association,
sure. Yeah,
but it
exactly.
is disheartening that a doctor still can't diagnose an aneurysm.
So this is all good stuff. It's all good stuff. We're voicing our concerns and our questions and asking for these things to be addressed so that people, coming behind us, have a better chance of a easier time with it.
Sure.
So one thing I can say for sure is
we've got a bigger saber to rattle now, more and more people getting involved and 7-night-a-week radio, the peer group support line. Craig is stirring all kinds of hornet nests out there as fast as he can go, He is out there stirring it up, boy. You name front, he's on it.
I love it.
Well, one thing my neurosurgeon did, I just want to say it, is he gracefully stepped away when he said he came and told me, he said, Les Paul, your situation is so severe, I'm going to step down and give you a new doctor that has come in that's considered the best in the field.
Wow.
And I wish anyone who needed that kind of thing, or if they need a center or something like that, they would get it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Absolutely.
Well, you have to give him credit for that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
a lot of doctors, wouldn't do that.
That's
well,
sure.
And on the inverse,
really,
on the inverse for mine, what was good is that the only doctor in town who could do that was a business surgeon who could do the clipping
technique. That was
and
divine
he came.
Intervention.
Yeah, he came to do. I mean, he left the hospital. He was at the med center doing that, but he heard about my case and took it on. Of course, it was like a true test of his craft, you know. I guess half the city within the surgery suite or whatever you call it, watching him do the procedure. Yeah. I wondered, you know, they never had me sign a brain release. I should be rich, you know, somewhere out there. My naked brain is out there exposed and everybody's seeing it get clipped. I think they should have given me a bonus for that. Heck, an extra.
Right, definitely.
Heck, I wasn't even an extra. Yeah. I starred in my own show, you know.
You starred in your own show is right.
Right.
But that you definitely had some guardian angels looking out for you. I look at Mike and he, there's no way he should have survived. You know, and it really, you know, I look at my younger brother when he got shot in the head 16 years later. I'm and I hate to say this, but I'm grateful that he passed away and he didn't live a life like my brother has. Because my brother hasn't had, you know, he's had some good people out there. I'm not. I have to give them credit. There's been some awfully good people with my brother, but you know, our experiences, especially, well, I don't know. Since I took over guardianship, we're not that good. But I feel they took advantage of me and my own health issues at the time that were no fault of mine. They took advantage of that. And, you know, it's just really unfortunate. But that's, you know, it's okay. I've gotten over that. And, I would really like to see some justice here and you know, see things taken care of. But you know, I look at Mike, you know, and you know, he is a miracle. For 45 years, he's lasted even through what he's gone through in the healthcare business. And, you know, and a lot of, I was talking to friends today, they were saying, and I've had people tell me this for years, saying, you know, they really feel that Mike has been here for me.
Hmm.
You know, and he truly had, he did save my life here in, you know, here in Pittsburgh. Had it not been for him, I don't think I would have made it through what I went through. He may not realize that, but I think on a soul level he does. And, you know, I'm so grateful to my brother. And I had told one of the doctors in the last, well, 3 years ago, I said, you know, I told, they know my whole journey because I have nothing to hide because that's, I think it's important. And, you know, I said, Mike saved my life and I owe him my life. And the doctor said, he certainly did and you certainly do.
Hmm.
So, you know, Mike is very, very special to me.
Now, don't give away the
so
whole story.
We're going to be moving on.
we'll be celebrating.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if you got my message. You'll have to check it out, and I'll talk to you. I know you're busy with your dad and mom, and some things developed yesterday, so I did message you about it. And I'm going to see where this goes in the next week. Yeah,
good.
Give it a week, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
I'm very encouraged. You know, I would like to, in my own situation, I would like to see resolution and be at peace with this. Now, I am at peace with what has happened, but things still are not right. And so hopefully we'll be seeing something happening here.
Yeah, could you resend me that, Tracy? Because I wonder if I accidentally.
Yeah,
I sent it.
Yeah, I sent it on Facebook, and I don't see it up here. So
the problem. If you find it, will you resend it? I'm kind of bad about that.
Well, I get so many messages. I know. I have to. You know, and I keep meeting more and more people, in this.
I know. Then
isn't
I can't
interesting?
Find
I don't
those.
See it here. Isn't
that
funny? Yeah, I'll send it to you. Yeah.
While you're
you know,
looking.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a quick 5-minute break. I wanted to tell those of you who've heard about, I talked to our friend John Cruz, and they put off his radiation treatments. He's not going to be starting them. I thought he was going to be halfway through them, but the place where the tumor is on resting on his brain stem, they needed, I don't know what they needed, but they put it off just
for another week or two, but he's I had a chance to visit with him. I wanted to check in and see how he was going because I thought he was going to be half through with it, but unfortunately, you know, he hasn't been able to work for a long time, and he's in a really dreadful place. You know, he hasn't even started the radiation yet. He lives on his own, and the money has been flying out the window, and he's not able to work and doesn't have benefits. So he told me when I was talking to him about this song I'm going to play, and we'll take a five-minute break to grab a drink or just sit back and take a breath and listen to the song. But when he wrote this song many years ago, his faith wasn't near as strong as it is now, and the name of the song is In the Palm of Your Hand, and he had God or a higher power in mind, and that's who I'm sending up a lot of prayers to now for John. It's bad enough, you know, when we have these physical and emotional challenges, but then to maybe face some really bad things in back of the financial challenges, not even talking about the bills, but roof over the head and eating and things like that, you know, and count our blessings, you know, that we have and send up our prayers for John. So I'm going to play This is the Palm of Your Hand by John Cruz Blues.
A beautiful song. Like a jewel, oh, have
John Cruise, Blues, singing In the Palm of Your Hand.
And to think what he's going through, wow. Mm.
Yeah. And some of what he's been through, when his daughter, he's got a only daughter now. I met her when she was young. She's older now, probably, I bet she's maybe in her later 20s by now. But when she was a little girl, her mother was killed in a violent crime. John's wife was killed, and he raised his daughter on his own. And he just became a grandpa times three not long ago. And now some big changes going to go on in his life. Of course, we pray that he gets through. It's going to be something like 28 straight days of radiation.
Ooh,
and it's not even with the thought of getting rid of the tumor. It's with the thought of keeping it from growing.
Hmm.
Goodness, that's bad.
Wow.
But hey, it's not in our control.
No,
right.
It's not. And he's scared, but he's got a lot of faith in that. He'll need it. I'm glad he's got it. You know, strong faith. So, I'm hoping he'll be able to join us on the show some night. But this song, the CD that this is on, the one CD that his band made before they broke up, that band, it was probably 20 years ago. And so John, you know, isn't even selling these, you know, his CD's not for sale anywhere. That's why I don't give a website. And when I got a hold of him, he was just so happy, and it was pretty neat. It was just weird, uncanny timing, like it always is. But he had just found out he had a brain tumor about 2 months before I got a hold of him, and he was so happy just that his music was going to be being played. But,
oh, how nice.
But when I talked to him, it was weird because, I mean, I could have been calling about any show on the planet, but here's a guy I knew, you know, 20 years ago, haven't talked to or seen, you know, for a really long time, and I'm calling to see about if I can play his music on Brain Injury Radio, and he's just been diagnosed with a brain tumor. So, I just thought that was kind of uncanny, like when I got a hold of Garfan, you know, Dale Hayes, and you know, our show is really able to help Dale quite a bit. And Dale's wife, Tracy, you might not have been at that show, but his wife is kind of in the situation that Mike has been in. She's been there for 8 years.
Wow.
And,
wasn't at that show, I don't think. Yeah, wow.
He's very kind. Mm. I just think it's pretty cool that some of these people that he'd wind up, you know, having a brain connection to, you know. When all I was looking for was music, you know, and out of about six people
that
responded, two of them, you know, had two out of six had some kind of a brain deal going on. And I've said before, and I'll just keep saying, because I think it's worth people remembering, is that it's easy to get, and I want to remember this, you know, as I'm going forward in these next weeks and months, is it's real easy to get tied up in our own dilemma, you know, and
it is, yeah,
you know, John or Dale have all the reasons in the world, you know, to just be into their own thing, and yet they were the ones who stepped up and wanted to help others.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
I'd like to think that karma will come back to them, you know.
Yes.
I know
yes,
what you mean.
I'm sure it will. Yeah, I'm sure it will, you know. Yeah, it's really amazing, you know, when you step up and give out to others, you're giving to yourself as well.
Right.
You know, when you're doing something for another person, you're doing that for yourself too. You know, it's the act of giving that you're actually receiving.
Exactly.
I believe that with all my heart. You're right about that.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting yesterday. I made some calls and some agencies, and I met this woman that, you know, worked at this agency, and ironically, her son had been suffered brain injury, and he was a victim of a drive-by shooting. And you know, it's like, and he lives at home with her, and she works at this agency that's not really affiliated with brain injury, sort of in the healthcare industry though. And you know, just connecting with people and sharing. You know, we shared together. You know, what we've gone through. Her as a mother. You know, and similar instances really. And we talked about, you know, why would people do stuff like this, and you know, in Mike's case, it was about anger. You know, at our time, it was during the civil rights movement, and there was a lot of anger out there, and there still is. And
yeah.
You know, it's you know, we've come to a time where, you know, it's time for forgiveness and to really embrace one another as human beings. You know, and really being there for each other. You know, recently I found the guy, actually, this is amazing, I found the guy that shot my younger brother online, and I talked to the prison.
God.
I researched him. This was, it was 29 years ago, and this was a friend of his, and they had been drinking, and he never served time for my brother's murder. I found that out. He served 100 hours of service, but he has served time since then for burglary. And I found his mugshot online. So I called the, you know, now that we have free long-distance service, and or you know, it's a lot cheaper than it was back 29 years ago, and we have the Internet. I did call he was the first homicide in Lake Havasu, Arizona. So I called the police station and talked with a sergeant down there. And you know, I actually called the prison where he's out of prison now, but I saw where he you know, had served time for burglary. So I talked to the prison, woman at the prison, and we talked about him, and I did find his address on the Internet, and I told the sergeant at the thing. He said, yeah, there were a lot of mistakes made when this happened.
Yeah.
And I wasn't in a position to go down there. You know, but I've always, you know, I forgave him a long time ago. I think back in 2003, that's when I went through a major forgiveness period in my life. And you know, I always felt bad for him because he had to live with this all his life. But then here he's been still in drugs and alcohol and, you know, burglaries. You know, just looking at, you know, looking at his face, he looks like such a wounded soul. You know, what did he go through in his lifetime to cause him to do something like this? And so I was talking to the investigator at the police station. He looked into the case and explained what happened. And, you know, I said, I think what I'm going to do is write him a letter and offer him my forgiveness and in the hopes that he can forgive himself. For his own healing, you know, and I think by doing that helps me place it into, you know, it's released that energy, you know. But I've never been even the guys that shot my brother Mike. I've never, you know, I looked at it as he was a product of our society at the time, you know, with a lot of anger during civil rights and. You know, the blacks were really against, you know, I mean, it's just a whole civil right thing. And, you know, what did these two young teenage heroin addicts go through? You know, so who brought the heroin into our streets? You know, who, you know, I mean, you'd look at the whole context of the thing. I had a newspaper reporter back in 2002, 2003 that was looking in because I wanted to find these guys out in California that shot Mike. And then the Afghanistan war broke out, and he got involved with that whole issue. So that kind of fell by the wayside. You know, but I would, if they're still around, I would like to offer my forgiveness to them in person. And by doing stuff like that, you actually shift the whole energy of the energy field, you know, around our planet. You know, when you start forgiving people for stuff, and so you know, what a great opportunity for me.
Well, that's
But see, that's all part of my own healing journey.
Yeah, exactly. I was gonna say.
So you know, it's
I'm sorry. You're just making me think of a dear friend of mine who was shot several times by her husband, and she actually forgave him. She said she couldn't go any farther without forgiving her. She's a strong Christian woman, and she said, God forgave me at the cross, so how can I not forgive him? And, I mean, it was hard for me to even hear that. I was angry because I love this person, dear friend of mine. I said, how can you do that? She said, how could I not?
Yeah.
And she's always got a smile on her face. This woman is really...
Well, the forgiveness is really not... you know, whether the other person is open to receiving it.
Yeah.
But it's mostly for yourself because it frees up your energy.
I was going to say part's not your business. The effort on your part is
that's
the healing part.
Yeah, they're doing it. They're doing a movie that's going to be coming out. Producer, I actually met her through Mar Beth Dunn.
Oh, really?
And it's called Project Forgive, and she's going around filming people, and I think she's going to have Deepak Chopra on it, and I tried to hook up Michael Beckwith with her.
God, she better have you on it.
Yeah. Well, I submitted my story to Dawn, but my story is just, you know, it's been a lifetime of tragedy after tragedy. I mean, I've had a lot, you know, my doctor said, Tracy, your life has been all about, you know, your journey in this life is about forgiveness. You know, that was your lesson in this lifetime, you know, and I think you're
hear that. Big time.
Well, that is a good note for me to say that we're winding down to the end of the show.
Yeah, I have to go. Yeah. Well,
and,
God bless you both.
Yeah.
And stay in touch.
Frank's
and
been there,
you're in our prayers.
Yeah.
You still there, Thanks. Frank?
He's gotten very quiet on us if he's still there. You there, Frank?
Well, he's still on the line with an open mic, but
Well, we love you, Frank.
Yep, we love you, Frank. And I would just want to thank everybody who was here tonight listening to the show and participating. And, again, we want to thank our sponsor, Gordon Johnson, TBILaw.com. Remember, if you missed part of the show or you just want that support, all of our live shows are immediately archived. And in the on-demand section on Brain Injury Radio, I'm going to close out the show tonight with something that we all need, and Tracy made me think about it, talking about forgiveness, but this is Kathleen Edwards singing A Soft Place to Land, which is something that we all need, and I'm just going to tell everybody goodnight now and let the song play
good night,
out.
Good Kim.
Good night,
Beth.
Everybody.
Good
night, everybody.
That was a great one.
Good night, Frank.
Thanks so much. Good night.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Soft place to